Hello, and welcome to another edition of Interviewing the Legends, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency, devoted to promoting musicians and authors worldwide. Call us today at 941-877-1552 to start your free publicity evaluation. Remember, we shine only when we make you shine. Please welcome the host of Interviewing the Legends, music journalist, author, and entrepreneur, Ray Shasho.
Hello, hello again, everyone. I'm Ray Shasho. Welcome to the show where we interview legendary and up-and-coming music artists and authors. Brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Call us today at 941-877-1552 or email us at publicityworksagency.com. Remember, we shine only when we make you shine. The Pineapple Thief have launched their brand new video for Try As I Might, the new single from their forthcoming new studio album, Disillusion. The highly anticipated follow-up to 2015's Your Wilderness is the band's second album to feature King Crimson and Porcupine Tree drummer Gavin Harrison. Vocalist, songwriter, and guitarist Bruce Sword explained his dystopian view. The video follows the theme of the song and the album. If you sign up to this hyper-connected world we live in, then you have to live with the consequences. Try as you might to get out of it. The futuristic clip is created by Black Tide Phonic Visual director George Laycock, who expands on how he created the film. When the Pineapple Thief came to me with their track, Try As I Might, they had a broad basis for an idea for a music video that dealt with a social media-obsessed connected world. I agree. This had nods to previous films and television like The Truman Show, Black Mirror, The Big Brother Landscape, and its preceding shows. So it was about creating a storyline using these broad influences and encapsulating into an obscure 3-minute film on a budget. I wasn't interested in the concept of in-eye cameras, scary technology, and I'm sure isn't too far away from us. We decided to go down the optical medical route and follow our character on a journey from first pre-operation to surgery, recovery, and then trying to battle the decision he has made while battling with the corporation he has signed up to. The film hopefully leaves the viewer to create their own conceptions on his outcome. We filmed it all on the Dorset, Devon coastline around where I live, and we're fortunate to be able to secure great locations to shoot, and with a few favors, including a remote seaside postmodern house, a private beach, and a real working hospital and opticians. To keep the cast down to a minimum, we decided that the camera that is watching Bruce would become the main supporting actor, and his nemesis appearing in scenes without anyone operating it. This allowed us to see the camera point of view and tell the story of the fictional viewer. This old broadcast camera weighed an absolute ton, and carrying it through remote woods down a mile-long steep cliff path to a beach was a challenge on some of the hottest days of the year. Filming in the water at the end was a welcome refreshment. The Pineapple Thief have grown to become one of the leading lights of Europe's experimental rock domain. Your Wilderness produced 4 million-plus album streams and was number 7 in UK independent charts, and 2 extensive headline European tours, culminating at London's Islington Assembly Hall, where the concert was recorded for the live release, Where We Stood. And their new album, Disillusion, promises to propel the band to even greater heights. The Pineapple Thief is a progressive rock band started by Bruce Sword in 1999 in Somerset, England. The band has released 11 studio albums. The Pineapple Thief is Bruce Sword on vocals and guitars, John Sykes on bass, Steve Kitch on keyboards, and Gavin Harrison on drums, who played with British progressive rock bands Porcupine Tree and King Crimson. Dissolution, the brand new release by the Pineapple Thief, will be released in various formats and available to pre-order now or available to purchase on August 31st, also on Amazon.com. Please welcome singer, guitarist, composer for progressive rock's The Pineapple Tree, Bruce Soar, to the show. Hello, Bruce.
Hello. How are you doing? Can you hear me?
I can hear you, yes. I was worried
Wonderful.
There that we lost you.
Yeah, I thought, yeah, don't lose me. Yes, so I'm good. I'm very good. Very, 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 very relaxed at the moment, thanks.
Good. You know, you have a great Game of Thrones name, Lord Sword.
Yeah, it was Jonas. I don't know if you know the band Catatonia, but it was Jonas from Catatonia who coined that phrase. He introduced me on stage as Lord Sword.
And oh, really?
It's stuck. Yeah, it's stuck ever since. Well, I don't mind it. I quite like it. Yeah, it's a nice name.
That's pretty cool. You could be one of the characters. I mean, I don't know if you watch Game of Thrones, and I'm a big fan. You know,
you can't get away from Game of Thrones. It's everywhere.
It's terrible, isn't it? I mean, yeah. You know, I can watch 5-6 episodes in an hour. You know, it's ridiculous. Yeah. But yeah, I love the show. I'm actually up to, the fourth year right now.
Blimey.
Episode 3 or 4 or something like that. And I was very, yeah. very upset when they killed, Robert, right? Robert Stark?
Right.
And his mom. I said, what the heck are you doing? Because he was one of my favorite characters.
Yeah.
First of all, I want to tell you, Amazon.com has the name of the album misspelled. Did you know that?
Oh, you're joking.
No.
Do you know what? The number of things that they get wrong, you know, like they put it as region, you know, Europe only for the Blu-ray, which is wrong. And we get so many people going, oh, I can't get your Blu-ray because we won't play in the States. And so, yeah. Right. Okay. How have they spelled it?
They spelled it D-I-S-S-O-U-L-T-I-O-N.
Oh,
I had to
wonderful.
Do a double take. Yeah,
right,
I had to do a double
right.
take.
Maybe there's a U.S. special edition with a different title, you know. But yeah,
maybe.
I'll get that changed. I will get on to my label and give them a going over.
I've got a couple of books on there that I've written, so I know the issues you can have with
yeah.
Amazon, but they're pretty easy to work with, I think. They'll fix it. How did you arrive at the Pineapple Thief as a name for the band?
Oh, God, yeah, I mean, that was, I have to go right back to 1999 to remember coming up with the name. It was, before I did Pineapple Thief, I was in a band called Vulgar Unicorn. It was a very obscure prog rock band, and I was on a tiny little record label, and I wanted to do my own thing, because I was just a guitarist in this other band, really. And I sent a song to the label, the guy on the label, and called Private Paradise. And the guy really liked it, and he emailed me back and said, right, let's put this out. I need a name. Give me a name right now. And I was like, oh, my God, you know, okay, this will just be one album. Let's just come up with a name. And I was watching a film with my girlfriend, who's now my wife, an American indie film called Eve's Bayou. And there's a scene in there where this voodoo lady sees this girl steal the Pineapple Thief, this young little girl. And she says, I can see you, Pineapple Thief. And I said to my missus, I said, well, that would do. That would do as a name, wouldn't it? And that was it. And so that's the name that stuck for nearly 20 years. So I had no idea we would do 12 albums. I thought it would just be a one album thing. So
that's a lot of albums. It's amazing.
It is.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's got to be challenging as far as songwriting, too, you know, when you put out so many albums, you know, it's like, what do I do next?
Yes, it's a weird thing. There's a weird cycle that you go through, and it's like, I think it's pretty much every 2 years that a Pineapple Thief album comes out, roughly speaking. And because we're not like a global, you know, some of the huge bands, you know, bands like Muse will tour for 14 months of the year, you know, and mm-hmm. go around the world. And then they would be under pressure to write their next album, and then they'd go on and hit the road. But for this band, it's not quite like that. You know, we do a lot of gigs, but we have an awful lot of time to write. So when it comes to sitting down, you know, I just think to myself, right, I've got 6 months or maybe 8 months to write a record, and where do we take it? And but you're right. Keeping it fresh after 12 records is a challenge.
Well, I guess it helps now that you got Gavin, you know, which was a huge addition to the band, obviously.
I think there was sort of lots, various epochs of the Pineapple Thief. There was the initial epoch where it was just me as a solo artist that went for the first five albums, probably. And then we moved to a bigger label, thanks to Stephen Wilson, actually, because he heard one of the records and he got in contact with me and said, Bruce, you've got to get onto a decent record label and put in a good name, put in a word for me, and got me the record deal. And then there's the third era of the Pineapple Thief is when Gavin joined. So, it's been, when you talk about how do you get the inspiration to keep writing and to make it fresh, I think Gavin coming on board was a great, like you said, you know, you couldn't ask for a better drummer to play with. But the key thing with Gavin was that he was a great writing partner. We got on really well, and our ideas were pulling in the same direction in terms of musical ideas, and so we had a really fruitful relationship when it came to writing, and I think that's the key thing about the new album.
Yeah, I heard on an interview how you guys work together, not actually in the studio, but I think in the future you're going to start working in the studio a little bit more, I think is what you said.
I think so, yeah. I mean, because budgets, you know, you don't have the huge budgets that you used to do in the heydays of the 70s and 80s with massive record deals, you know. We had to make the most of the money we had and time as well. And so we were doing it remotely in our studios. But ironically, you know, listening to you read the biography, you know, we were using social media and connecting every day as a band. So it felt almost like we were in the same room when we were writing. It's as close as you could get to being in the same room. And so I think, I regret, you know, that telling people that, yeah, we recorded it all in separate places, because everyone's going, oh, well, it must have been a really sterile environment and blah, blah, blah. But it wasn't. It felt really organic. You know, I hate to use the phrase organic, but it was very natural. And I think that comes across in the music.
It's funny. You know, the album concept was pretty much how technology has been kind of a negative thing, but you use that technology for you and Gavin to record the
album. Exactly, yeah. It's a complete and utter contradiction. But, I mean, that's the thing. I certainly wouldn't get on my soapbox and say, look, we should all delete Facebook, we should smash up our phones, and, you know, it's not that at all. But I think it's certainly got, for me, it's certainly gone too far. And, I mean, I saw a stat the other day that people are looking at their phone on average 50 times a day. Yeah. And that can't be good for your mental well-being and your mental welfare. So it's an interesting world, an interesting time that we're living through. So yeah, that was the real crux of the theme of the record.
No, I agree with you 100%. There's too many kids that, like you said, all day long, that's all they do is look at their phone. And
well,
I don't know what they're doing on their phone.
No, exactly. I've got 11-year-old twin boys, and and to they've known nothing else. You know, this is the only thing they've ever known. The only way they're contacting and connecting and talking to their friends.
Right.
This is natural for them, and it's very, very I don't think we know what we're doing yet. And I think that, you know, in 100 years time, when people look back on this, a bit like the Industrial Revolution and you know, the Wall Street crash, all that kind of thing, we look at it and think, well, we didn't realize that it was a problem, you know, and didn't know how to recognize it as a problem, like being an alcoholic or a drug addict. You're addicted to your phone. And it's interesting to hear Apple talk about smartphone addiction for the first time. And so it's all very, very far too new for anyone to really understand at the moment, I think.
You know, on the other hand, you know, kids have everything at their disposal nowadays. You know, we would have to go to the library, use a typewriter, a regular typewriter, to type anything. You know, they can look up things in seconds, and, you know, and there's no excuse for them not to know our history, because it's
true.
Right there in their fingertips. And that's what that's what pisses me off, and especially music, when they don't know the artist, you know, especially all the artists that I interview. You know, I interview a lot of the 60s, 70s, and 80s, and Now I'm getting to the 90s because 90s is considered classic rock. And when they go, I don't know who that is. I said, what do you mean you don't know who that is?
Oh, my goodness. You know? It's scary when you're saying, oh, 90s is classic rock, really? Oh, my goodness.
90s is,
you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, and people are saying to me that, oh, so you've got a vintage, so you are now a vintage band because we're playing with guitars, bass, and real drums. You know, you've got a real drummer, and I don't know what is this. Are we saying that the traditional format of a band is something that's vintage? That's something that is yesteryear? And I don't think so. I mean, if you look at the global music market and the kind of bands that are selling out stadiums, and I think guitar bands are here to stay, I hope.
They've just been erased from the mainstream, like mainstream radio, which is stupid because
they
still have an audience, you know, a huge audience. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, look at Roger Waters. Roger Waters is selling out stadiums all over the world, you know, now. So, it's frustrating as an artist, definitely.
Well, the guitar player, you know, the guitar hero, he's almost gone. You know, the Jimmy Pages, you know, the David Gilmours, the Robin Trowers, you know, those guys.
Yeah.
You know, which is very sad, you know.
It is sad, yeah. Yeah, you're right. And I don't know who was the last one. Who was the last, you know, guitar hero that was there? Where was the last Dave Gilmour? You know, I don't know.
Well, his son is playing, Matthew.
Yes. Yeah.
I'm friends with David's wife, ex-wife.
Oh, really? Right.
David's ex-wife. Right. Yeah, she's cool. She's really, really cool. The new album is great. I mean, I didn't get a chance to listen to all the music because nobody sent me the album. Which is a shame.
It is a shame.
Yeah, I try as I might. It's a very, very cool song. Awesome video. And I got to listen to Far Below, another great, you know, cool music video, awesome track. What do you think is different about this album compared to some of the other albums?
I think, it's a shame you haven't heard it. I mean, but those two tracks, you know, it's just a real snapshot, really. It's the whole record is the difference, I think. The key difference with this record was that it was built from the ground up as a collective. And my traditional way of creating a Pineapple Thief album was being a bit of an auteur. I would do everything. I would write the song and I'd go, hey guys, here's the song. And you could tell, you know, that they were creatively, they were thinking, well, okay, this is great. I'll do what I can, but the song's already there. Whereas this time I just came up with an idea and or a riff or a melody. And then I give it to Gavin and he would come up with some rhythmic ideas and chop things around, send it back. And then our bass player would go, oh, wow, this is great. And he would start adding to it. So creatively, as a unit, it was very, very different. And I think everyone in the band much preferred it that way because everybody was bought into it. And so that was, and I think that's what ended up, you know, what we created as a band was something I've no idea how we got there, to be honest. It was just one of those things. It took 6 months to do the whole record, and every day you're thinking, where's it going to go today? Because it was almost out of my control. It was in my control, but out of my control, if you know what I mean, and in a really nice way. So that was the big difference. And so, yeah, I think ultimately it's the first out. Well, I wouldn't say the first album, but the most band created album that I've ever been involved with.
There's a lot of buzz around Threatening War. A lot of people talking about that track. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. And again, you know, I remember how that one came together because I came up with this. Threatening War starts off with this acoustic guitar riff and vocal, which, you know, I just came up with, sent it to Gavin, and then he just went off, you know, and just and he would often send me back sections where it's just him drumming and I would go, wow, listen to that, and that would inspire me to go in different directions and that's the, I think that's the real beauty of when you've got a band that gets on and there's no egos saying, right, I'm the guy, I'm gonna write all the songs and has to be this way. That you just come up with something that no individual could come up with on their own. And so yeah, I'm glad that, you know, 12 albums in that this is happening because it's certainly given us a new lease in life.
Now the album was recorded in about 6 months. Is that correct?
It was, yeah. And you say that's a. I mean, there's a flip side of the of the of this is the thing, you know, we're living in this in an age where I've got a good studio in my house. Gavin's got a great studio, brilliant drum room, and so his drum kit's permanently set up with the best mics you could possibly want on a drum kit. So we've got the best studio that you could need to record, and it's in our houses, so it doesn't cost anything. But it does mean that you can just, there is just no stop button. You just keep going, keep going, keep going. So every day we would wake up and we would just keep working and keep working. Whereas the old, you know, the traditional idea that of the in the heydays of the 70s, where a record label would pay for a band to go in a big residential studio for 6 weeks, and they had 6 weeks to do the record. You know, you're going to finish the record in 6 weeks, and we need the single, and blah, 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 blah. So there is a positive to having that kind of pressure, I think, to having that deadline, because I think if we didn't have a deadline, the deadline we had was that Gavin had to go off with King Crimson, and so that was the only deadline we had. But we had 6 months, and that's a long if you imagine being in the studio for 6 months, that's what it felt like. But at the end of it it felt really great. But there were times in the middle of the recording process where I was so exhausted, where every day you're songwriting, you're tweaking, you're seeing where a song can go, trying things, throwing things in the bin that don't work. It was very tiring, but you know, I can't complain. But it was a long process.
Yeah, it's amazing, you know, when you hear about all the songs the Beatles wrote. You know, oh, they wrote this one in 10 minutes. They wrote this one in 5 minutes.
Yeah, exactly. but then you read about Wish You Were Here was written. You know, camped out in a studio for goodness knows how long, you know, in Abbey Road, you know, just slowly grinding out that record. But you know, it's one of the greatest records of all time that they came up with. And I don't think there's any magic answer to how to make an album.
Not only that, you're the producer and the engineer as well, so you got you're working both parts of the spectrum there of the album. How do you like producing and engineering your music, your own music?
My own music is different. Yeah, it's a bit harder, actually, I must confess. And I've got a good relationship with my keyboard player. My keyboard player runs a mastering business, so he's got this ridiculous setup in his studio. His speakers are probably worth more than my house. It's just unbelievable. And so I send him my mixes as I'm going, and he will always send me the critique. He says, "Oh, Bruce, you know, the guitars are sounding a bit, you know, muffly or something like that, or there's too much sub," or so I would. It's a lot easier for me when I'm mixing other bands, you know, because it's immediately you're there and it's fresh. You hear it for the first time and you go, right, I know what this needs, da, da, da. When you've heard something every day for months on end, it can be difficult to have a perspective on it. But I certainly wouldn't want to farm out the mixing to anyone else, you know, because I'd certainly like to have control. One thing we were really careful about with the new album Dissolution was to make it really hi-fi, you know, 3D, you know, really have a load of depth, and really dynamic. And so we've kept all the mixing and the mastering, because Steve does the mastering in-house, which was really nice in this day and age, because we have, you know, had some albums where we've suffered with mixes and we've suffered with mastering, you know, the dreaded loudness wars. Some of our records, we've reissued them now, but they were squashed to hell and ruined.
Right.
You know? So, which is, it's a common story, but I think we're coming out of that now. We're coming out of the, nobody cares about loudness anymore.
Right, that's true. Well, you do a great job. The qualities of your albums are fantastic.
Thanks very much.
You do a wonderful job. Now, there's a second disc of music included with the deluxe edition, right, which contains a lot of acoustic versions of the songs?
This is the thing. I mean, our label, K-Scope, they always like to do, and I think probably you can blame Stephen Wilson for starting this off, because with the special editions, you know, the big booklets with 100 pages and 4 discs, so it's got a Blu-ray with all the 5.1 mixes that I've done.
Yeah.
And then the bonus sort of acoustic disc, when I sat down, I said to the label, okay, I'm going to do some acoustic versions. I thought, right, I'll just do some, throw down some quick acoustic versions. He said it didn't turn out like that, because I felt once you start something, you don't want to compromise. So I ended up re-recording everything and reinterpreting all the songs. So the songs are very, very different. but with acoustic guitar. And our touring guitarist, a guy called George Marius, who's a fantastic guitar player, he's added some electric guitar. So it's a very, very different interpretation of the record. So, yeah, it's nice. But it's K-Scope, they make these additions, and they make the record collectible. They make people want to buy the physical product, which is quite rare in this day and age. And I think being in the progressive rock realm, we're one of the few sort of genres where people still buy the product. They still want to have the product. They want to buy the vinyl. They want to buy the booklet, you know. And I remember as a buying, you know, loving the gatefolds and flicking through the booklets, you know, and I never want to forget that. So they're still doing a really good job of selling the music, which is obviously good for us.
Yeah, I couldn't believe how many different formats it's available in. I've never seen anything like that before.
No, it's the most that we've ever had. I think there's the Blu-ray, there's a special edition, there's a white vinyl, there's a crystal clear vinyl, there's a black vinyl, I think there's a red vinyl somewhere.
So
there's obviously the standard CD. So there's goodness. And I do know there's, because I've met them on tour, there are collectors out there who have to have everything. And so I think when they see all these formats, they're like, oh my God, Bruce, what are you doing to me? And, you know, they have to go out and buy the lot, which I do feel a bit bad for them. But, you know, it's out of my control. I blame the label.
I just had John Lodge on a few days ago.
Oh, yeah.
Moody Blues. We talked about Days of Future Past. And that was a big breakthrough album because of the sound quality, you know.
Right.
It was like one of the first, you know, kind of stereotype. I think they called it, was a Derma Sound or something like that. It was one of the first of its kind. And which was interesting because they were asked just to produce some songs on like half of the album just for people to sell it, you know, for stereo salesmen, you know, to as a demo. And it ended up being, you know, a classic album, which was really cool.
I know it is cool, isn't it? And if you can imagine being in an era where stereo is this new amazing thing, and you know, I just things like, oh my God, you know, I can't remember which Beatles album was the first time they had stereo drums, and to think that before then it was always mono drums. It was, you know, it's incredible, really. Yeah.
Yeah, but you know, all those mono Beatles songs in the '60s. 45 still sound great to me. They're very clear.
They do. They do. Yeah. And that's something that actually a lot of sound engineers forget. They forget to push the mono button when they're mixing, because, you know, there's a lot of records nowadays that sound terrible in mono. But I don't know how many people listen to stuff in mono nowadays, but, you know, it's still important.
Well, your tour, September 15th, I think, you go on the road in Paris, correct?
That's right. Yeah, it just sold out. Actually, Paris has sold out. So that's another thing that's we're really pleased about, is that we're getting a lot more people to our shows. So yeah, we're going all around Europe in September, and then we're touring again in January next year, and we've also planning coming over to the States at the end of 2019. At last, yes, at last. I mean, you know, you wouldn't believe the number of people in the USA who say, when are you coming? When are you coming? And like, yes, but it's a very big place, you know. So we hope that people will come to our shows. But yeah, we should be announcing that soon.
Yeah, I heard the story of your last tour in the US. I think you're in Kansas somewhere and you got pulled over twice.
Oh, yes, I was opening for Stephen Wilson. I was doing, he said, Bruce, do you want to come over and just do an acoustic opener for me? And I just hopped on a plane with my acoustic guitar and hired a car. And but of course, I forgot how big America is, and so USA is. So I was driving, I think I drove 14,000 miles or something, or kilometers, and, you know, through Arizona and Utah. It was fantastic, you know. But yes, I did fall foul of the law enforcement twice, yes, in Kansas on the way to, I think it was Dent, was it? No, I can't remember. Yeah, Kansas City, on the way to Kansas City, which is quite scary, for a poor guy like me on my own. So hopefully that won't happen when we come over next time.
But what were you driving?
It was just a hire car. I can't remember what it was. It was a big white thing that I just hired. Right. And just threw my guitars in the back. But I think I was just going slightly over the speed limit, because in England, everyone drives over the speed limit. So I'm just so used to just doing, you can do 10, 20 kilometers over the speed limit. Yeah, that's fine. But no, it wasn't fine. So I got told off.
Maybe you should call Jack Osborne and let him take you around the state. He's good at it. Him and Ozzy have been traveling everywhere.
Really? Yes.
Actually, I like Jack. I like the way he's been handling things. He's very, very good at what he does, you know?
Yeah, yes. Yeah, absolutely he is, isn't he?
Well, some of the other albums I like, and I just want to talk about a little bit, some of my favorite songs from The Pineapple Thief. The Final Thing on My Mind from Your Wilderness is one of my great songs. That one kind of felt like a Sade feel to it, in my mind.
Sorry?
You know the band Sade?
Oh, yes, yeah.
Yeah, it kind of made me feel that kind of, you know, laid-back type.
Yeah, and a lot of people skive that, you know, they sort of tag us with being quite soft and laid back. I guess the way I sing is quite laid back, and I can understand your reference now. And but yeah, I agree. I mean, when we play live, that is one of the highlights. And again, when that was one of the influences of getting Gavin on board, because that song, when I wrote it, it was nowhere near as complex in terms of time signatures as it was when it finished, because Gavin came on board as a session drummer for Your Wilderness. But I think he just enjoyed the music so much that he came back to me and says, Bruce, how about we try this? Let's do this. Do you mind if I chop this around? And I think that's when the whole sort of new band began with Gavin, was when we did Final Thing on My Mind. And you know, Gavin's drumming on that track is just fantastic. So it's, you know, when we play it live, it's definitely a highlight.
Another great song from that album is In Exile. It's another song I really, really enjoyed.
Yes, it was really surprising how that song turned out. And again, a highlight live, and you know, Gavin's, you know, drumming again is fantastic. I think he's done a drum through. If you go on YouTube, Vic Firth have done a drum through where Gavin's just played that track through. And I think today, Vic Firth have just released a drum through of a track off the new album called White Mist, where Gavin's drums done one of his, you know, cams, where he has cams above him and from inside.
Right.
That's another favorite of mine.
Talk about the lyrics to No Man's Land.
Well, that one is about being a parent, actually, and from my perspective, but really from perspectives of people I know who've grown old, and when their children fly the nest, it's the impact that has on some people's lives, and how they can never really find a meaning for their lives when that happens, and and how, you know, how devastating it can be for some people. And also it covers the sort of estrangement, so the times where you kind of have this irreconcilable difference or fallout with your children, and you never speak to them again until, you know, and you die without ever seeing them again, and how awful and tragic that is. And so yeah, that was, I think there's a line on there where it says, look at me now, I'm in no man's land. I mean, that basically means, look at me now, what purpose have I got without my children? And
right.
You know, I'm not, that's not me, you know, I'm looking at my kids now running around, and they, you know, when they fly the roost, I'll be happy. I'll be going on holiday, you know. but you know, I know that's how it can affect some people. And again, that's I write about things that I witness, and so I witness these things in my life, and so I wrote about it.
You're a great songwriter, by the way, and you have a fantastic voice.
Thank you very much.
Very, very different, you know. Very soothing, very prog rock. You know, you have a terrific voice. The one savior in that is in Being an Empty Nester. is grandkids.
Yes.
Things change if they have, if they do have grandkids. And that's what I'm enjoying now. You said you have, do you have identical twin boys?
I do, yes. Yeah.
Well, we just had identical twin girl grandkids.
Oh, excellent. Yes. And you know what? My parents, you know, they are so happy. They're just so different as grandparents, as I remember them as my parents. They're just so happy. They just can't wait to see them. And, you know, they're so relaxed and chilled out. So, yeah. You're right. There's a real positive, isn't it?
You know why they're so happy? Because they can give them back to you.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
One song that should have been a hit, you know, I was a top 40 DJ back in the late 70s, too. And, you know, I had a hit, a song list in front of me, but I could go out of my realm and do whatever I want at times because I was a nighttime guy. But one song I think should have been a hit in mainstream radio. Let me see where it is now. Okay, yeah, 13137.
Oh, right. Blimey. Yeah, right back in the day. That was in 2002. And yeah, that was really when I was finding my feet. And that record, you know, the album was called 137. And I remember playing it to my friends and they all picked that track out as being the one that they loved. Yeah. Funny, we used to play that live. So maybe I should have a chat with the chaps and get that back in the set.
Great tune. It could be a movie soundtrack. I could see that,
right.
on a movie easily. It just stands out, you know?
Yeah, thanks.
Let's see. Preparation for Meltdown from Someone Here Is Missing, which is another great album.
Yes, yeah.
And could be my favorite song, West Winds.
Ah, of course, yes. Now that was from What We Have Sown, and I remember What We Have Sown album. I remember I was saying about Stephen Wilson coming on and
right.
putting a good word in for me, get onto new label. So I owed my old label one more record, and I didn't want to give them a live album or something, you know, lazy. So I said to him, right, I'll write a record for you, and I wrote it really quickly, and that turned into What We Have Sown, and it just became a real favorite with a lot of our fan base. And I wasn't really ready for it. And West Winds, I remember that track. I was just, that was really just me having a jam in the studio. I didn't give it any thought. And I think that's probably sometimes as a songwriter that you need that. Cause you, if you overthink things can go very wrong. And,
exactly.
But sometimes if you underthink things and think, oh, I'm just going to do this, it's going to be easy, things can go horribly wrong. But sometimes it just comes together. And with that track, it just, in hindsight, it worked. You know, it had that sort of, I don't know, it's that you could tell that I just let it run free when I was writing it and playing it.
Yeah, I've noticed a lot of musicians when I talk to them, they're overly critical about themselves, which drives them crazy.
That's the thing. It's a song. Yeah, it's a natural thing to always look at the flaws of everything you do. And you know, you were saying earlier about how do you how do you make it after so many records? How do you approach the new one? Is that you look back on what you've done and you hate it and you think, right, what am I gonna? Well, how can I make this better? And it's an ongoing. It's never satisfied. Never.
Sometimes, you know, mistakes are good.
Yes, exactly. And, you know, those happy accidents, you know, and happy mistakes. You don't realize it. Unfortunately, you don't realize until, you know, years afterwards when you look back in hindsight and go, oh, wow, yeah, that was really good. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
Mm. Well, Someone Here Is Missing turned things around, I think, for you guys. That was a critically acclaimed piece, which also featured the artwork of Storm Thorgerson. Which was really cool.
That was really cool, and I couldn't believe it when the label said that they were prepared to do it. You know, because the budget was obviously nowhere near what they had for Pink Floyd or Muse, and so it was great. And you know, I met Storm, and he spoke to me, and it grilled me about the record. And this was shortly, you know, this was only a few years before he passed away, and he had cancer. He had cancer when I met him, and he was talking openly about it. about the treatment he was having. I couldn't really had to touch, you know, pinch myself to think that, my God, you know, this is Storm Thorgerson. As a kid, I'd gone record collecting and I'd bought all these Hypnosis covers, you know, and flicked through the booklets, and there he was doing my album. It was, you know, I couldn't believe it. So yeah, that was a breakthrough, and it did bring us into the world of other people, you know, of new people. But we were still pretty underground, to be fair. But yeah, it was there was lots of little turning points in the history of the Pineapple Thief, I think.
Well, I'm a bit of an expert, I think, on prog rock. I've liked it ever since the beginning. To me, it's the greatest achievement to music, you know, besides maybe classical or, you know, anything like that, Renaissance music, that for the Brits than anything else. Or maybe, you know, like Lonnie Donegan and Skiffle, maybe. But, you know, prog rock is Brit's baby. And
yeah.
only the Brits can do it right. You know, there are bands like Kansas and things like that have done a good job about it, but it's so authentic. You know, when British bands play, you know, progressive rock, and it's, you know, I had a long talk with John Lodge about it. I said, John, you know, you should be very happy that, you know, the Brits have prog rock. I mean, that to me should be its own separate Hall of Fame. You know, and not even tied up to rock and roll. But then he kept tying American music and rock and roll. And I says, no. It's in your blood. It's in your DNA. It's from, you know, Game of Thrones period. You know,
yeah.
The knights and the castle. That you know, Renaissance music. It's all coming from you guys, from your history into prog rock. You know,
it's true. I'd never really thought about it like that, but like thinking back to the prog bands of the 70s that I grew up loving, you know, like Supertramp,
right?
Yes, Camel, you know, and the Stadium. But you know, the bands that were filling stadiums in the 70s, like Jethro Tull and ELP, all
ELP,
British.
Yeah,
yeah.
It's that's you guys. It's all about you. It to me,
yeah.
It has nothing to do with American music. It's in your DNA.
Right.
Period.
Yeah. Yeah,
you know, and I thank you for it because it's my favorite. You know, when I see Game of Thrones, I could hear all the, you know, I could hear ELP.
Yeah.
You know, I hear a lot of progressive rock bands. I could easily, you know, be part of that. You know,
yeah,
really, really cool. And talking about that, one of your most underrated albums has to be 8 Days. Oh my God, that is such a good album.
Yeah, I mean, and again, I mean, there was 3 8 Days. I think we've done 3 8. So the original 8 Days, with, mm-hmm. which was on Variation of a Dream, was when the record label back in then those days, he had an offer from the pressing plant of 1,000 free CDs, and he said to me, Bruce, we can do a bonus disc for the first 1,000 we press. Can you give me some stuff? And I thought, oh, I haven't really got anything. You know, you don't want to give them all the rubbish that you don't ever do. And I said, oh, I'll tell you what, let's do a song every day for 8 days and just do a record. And so I did it. And again, you know, when you're talking about, well, let's not think about it, let's just go with the flow and write stuff. And not, you certainly haven't got time to overthink it when you're doing it in one day and writing, recording and mixing it. That's how it came out. So I just thought it was a really interesting thing to put myself through. And then I did it again with 8 days later. And then we did it again for when we did Your Wilderness Special Edition, which had an 8 years later. Although that was probably about 2 or 3 weeks that we spent on that one.
That's a magical period. Am I? You know, it's so underrated. A couple of comments that I read about that album: criminally overlooked album.
Right.
Somebody said, "Effing sublime." I mean,
right, brilliant, yeah.
It is brilliant. The album cover, too, is so cool.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
Yeah, yeah, thanks.
It's a great album. I realize that some of your favorite guys growing up, I know one of them is Camel, right? You like the Mirage album?
Yes, yep.
They did a thing, I think Bruce's 10 guitar albums that blew his mind.
Oh, yes, that's right, yes.
Andy Latimer, Camel,
yes,
of course,
yep,
great guitar player. Steve Hackett was another one who I've had on the show. Love Steve. I've interviewed him several times. And also Corey Glover, Living Color, and I had Corey Glover on the show not too long ago.
Oh, I saw that, yeah, of course. No, Vernon Reed is the guitarist, Corey Glover the vocalist, but Living Color, mm-hmm, were, yeah, they were when I first met our bass player, you know, Living Color had just released Vivid, and you know, I loved, as a guitarist, I thought, wow, what is this? You know, loved it.
He's a great guitar player, yeah.
Yeah, fantastic.
What's your favorite progressive rock band?
Oh, that's a good question. I really loved early Supertramp when I was, I still do, you know, Crime of the Century is one of my favorite albums of all time. You know, you can't ignore Pink Floyd, Dark Side of the Moon and Wish You Were Here, you know, are up there in my Desert Island Discs. As I also, you know, it doesn't get quoted very much, but I used to really love the Alan Parsons Project. You know, he did an album called Tales of Mystery and Imagination, and I think that's just a fantastic piece of music, and iRobot after that, you know. So they were real influences of my to me when I was growing up in the 80s, you know, as a teenager.
Of course, Alan Parsons, part of the Dark Side of the Moon production.
Of course, yeah.
I saw Supertramp a couple of times. I've had Roger on. I've interviewed Roger. Really, really nice guy.
Right. I wish there's lots of bands where I just never got to see. Supertramp with the classic lineup, Pink Floyd with the classic lineup, and we had John Halliwell play a clarinet solo on Your Wilderness. So that was a big moment for me to have, you know, Supertramp's sax and clarinet player on one of my songs. It was a Yeah, another pinch me moment that was.
Oh wow! Which song was he playing on?
Oh god, you know what? My brain's just gone trying to remember the name of the song. It's on Your Wilderness, the soft one on Your Wilderness.
Okay.
I'm trying to sing it now. But yeah, he does this clarinet. We went up to Manchester and he did this clarinet solo for us. It'll come to me in a minute.
Okay. he's amazing. He really is amazing. I saw
Fend for Yourself. Fend for Yourself is the name of the song. Yeah.
Yeah, I'll look that up. Bruce, here's a question I ask everybody, and I get some interesting answers. If you had a Field of Dreams wish, like the movie, to perform or collaborate with anyone from the past or present, who would that be?
You know, it would be a real left field thing. I think, you know, everyone always says, oh, when's Bruce going to collaborate with Stephen Wilson or, you know, Michael from Opeth, you know. But actually, what I would really be interested to do was collaborate with Beck. You know, one of you, an American, you know, singer-songwriter. But Beck did a record called Sea Change, which I think is one of the most progressive records of the last 20 years. And it was engineered by Nigel Godrich of Radiohead fame and Roger Waters fame, and he had these string arrangements by his father, Beck's father, that were the most amazing string arrangements I've ever heard. I just love his songwriting, and I'd just really be interested to see if you plonk me and Beck in the same room, what would happen. So that would be my dream.
Great artist. Mm. Yeah, I agree with you. Well, do you have anything else you'd like to promote or talk about? We've got the tour coming up in Europe, and then next year.
Yeah, no, I think next year. I think the big thing is, if, you know, like we said, we know that all of the, because nowadays we're talking about social media and connectivity.
Right.
We know where our listeners are. We know where the most of our listeners are, and they are in the USA. You know, most of all our Spotify by far are in the USA. The number of comments that we get, when are you coming to USA? When are you coming to USA? So we're coming next year. So I just really hope that people come and say hello and come and see our show.
Well, we're really excited about you coming to the US. I hope you come to Florida. That's where I'm at.
Right.
I'm in Florida. There's the radio station. We broadcast from California, but, you know, a lot of people don't come as far south as Florida sometimes, but
no, it's difficult, isn't it? You'd imagine. I mean, whereabouts in Florida are you?
Well, actually, this is Brit country here. I'm in Sarasota, which...
Right.
You know,
So nowhere near Miami, I suppose, or
about 3 hours from Miami.
Right.
The closest city's Tampa. Tampa would be
right.
Good.
Oh, Tampa, good right, yeah, because Stephen Wilson's played Tampa, hasn't he? I'm pretty sure he has. So, I'll speak to our agent.
That'd be wonderful. If I can help in any way, I know a lot of the venues, I know a lot of people that promote shows here. You know, I can help you out if you like.
Great.
Give you some names.
Yeah, thanks.
You know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Bruce,
Cheers.
Thank you so much, man, for being on the show today and for all the incredible music. Looking forward to the brand new album from Pineapple Thief entitled Disillusion, and hopefully the American tour in the near future, and hopefully you'll come to Florida. And don't get pulled over.
Thanks.
Don't get pulled over.
Lovely chat. Thanks very much.
Thank you so much, Bruce.
Okay.
All right. Take care, man. Bye-bye.
All right, and you. See you later. Bye.
Bye-bye. Disillusion, the brand new release by the Pineapple Thief, will be released in various formats and available to pre-order now, as a matter of fact, at https://pineapplethief.link/disillusionpr, or you can wait till the end of the month, and it'll be available everywhere, including Amazon.com. And again, it'll be on various formats. The Pineapple Thief Disillusion Tour, 2018-2019, beginning September 15th in France, will be coming to the United States sometime in 2019. Visit their links for more information about the Pineapple Thief. Visit www.thepineapplethief.com. They're also on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Spotify, YouTube, and Apple Music. Very special thanks today to Billy James of Glass Onion PR for arranging this interview with Bruce Sword, and of course, the dynamic duo of Doug and Don Newsom of VBS Radio for making the magic happen for each and every broadcast of The Ray Shasho Show. If you have comments or suggestions for the show, contact me at The Ray Shasho Show. @gmail.com. Don't forget to purchase a copy of my book entitled Check the G's, the True Story of an Eclectic American Family and Their Wacky Family Business, available now at Amazon.com. I promise you will live it. Have a great week, everybody.
Thank you, everybody, for listening to Interviewing the Legends, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Call 941-877-1552 or visit us at publicityworksagency.com, specializing in author and music artist publicity plans. We shine when we make you shine. Tune in to Interviewing the Legends every Tuesday at 7 p.m. Pacific Time on VBS Radio, Station 1.